from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Bay Area now has at least 8 confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus, plus 2 more pending confirmation from the CDC. Alameda County declared a local public health emergency after officials there reported the county's first case yesterday. Coming up on Forum, we'll get the latest on the virus and its impact on the Bay Area economy, from canceled travel plans to people stocking up on canned goods and other supplies to strains on ports and supply chains. And we want to hear from you. How has the coronavirus affected your life so far? You can email us now at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org, or call 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up this morning following more than a week of steep declines fueled by the novel coronavirus epidemic. But trading is volatile and economists are worried. And today, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said it expects a sharp slowdown in global economic growth this month and warned that the virus could send more countries into recession if it continues to spread. Here in California, Facebook canceled its biggest industry conference of the year. San Francisco's Chinatown has experienced steep declines in revenue, and tourism watchers are on edge. After health officials report dozens of new cases in the United States over the weekend, we're going to sit down with industry experts to discuss the economic impact coronavirus is having on California. And joining us first here in studio is KQED's science reporter, Leslie McClure. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Michael.
So where do we stand? I mean, at this point, there are 8 confirmed cases and 2 pending.
Exactly. So I think the situation over the weekend reflects, I mean, things are changing really rapidly. Last week, I included, and public health officials were saying, wash your hands, the risk is low, be diligent, it's cold and flu season, that's a way bigger threat. That is still all very true. But over the weekend, as you said, we got a handful more cases here in the Bay Area. We had a couple more dozen cases across the country. Several more states and counties have declared public emergencies. Things are changing, and they're changing really fast.
And scary.
And scary.
5 new cases over the weekend. Solano, Alameda County, Santa Clara, a couple. In fact, Alameda has declared a health emergency.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, there was 2 healthcare workers at the North Bay Vaca Valley Hospital. These 2 healthcare workers tested positive. They're going to confirm that with the CDC, but it looks like these people got the coronavirus. So what we're seeing right now is community spread. The disease is on the ground and probably spreading. And what's important to note is that means there's a lot more cases out there that haven't tested positive. And some of the testing is showing that this disease may have been on the ground for a month or more.
Can you give us a sense of the advice we're hearing from health officials? What are they giving in the way of advice?
Yeah, there's not a lot you can do right now except for wash your hands. Make sure not to touch your face if your hands are dirty. I'd say wash your hands all day long. They are still not recommending that you wear a mask. It's also a good time to step back and kind of mentally prepare for the situation to change radically. On the ground, the risk is still low, but it's a good idea to talk with your kids about how things could change. What will happen if public transportation is suspended? Have you talked to your schools in case schools closed? Have you talked to your boss? Can you, you know, work from home? It's time to prepare for the situation to continue to change dramatically, and that's going to feel pretty surreal.
I want to ask you also about where we are just in terms of test kits and ventilators and drug supplies for that matter.
Yeah. There's not a real clear sense of what the situation is on the ground. The country is prepared for a bad flu season. It's a pretty bad flu season. So a lot of those supplies are being used right now. Are we ready for an epidemic to come on as well? The experts are kind of pausing, I would say, in response to that question. I would not say that we are readily prepared for that situation, but we know how to fight a flu. And so it depends on how quickly things move in terms of how fast we are going to be able to respond.
And I'd like to ask you sort of about the West Coast picture as well as the national picture. In the West Coast picture, Governor Inslee of Washington declared a state of emergency. There have been a number of cases, in fact, in confirmed cases. I know you're from Seattle. There have been confirmed cases in King County, about 18 of them. So the concern is this going to spread throughout the West Coast and maybe pretty rapidly?
It could. My mom goes to that hospital where those where those two folks have died in Washington. She lives right around the corner and had a doctor's appointment this week. So this is definitely hitting home on the West Coast. And it very likely could spread quickly on the West Coast. It looks like the two hotspots are here in the Bay Area and Washington around the Seattle area. But I'm sure people from both of those places have traveled widely in recent weeks. And so I would expect, and I don't like to speculate as a science reporter, but that this could take off on the West Coast.
Well, the president was talking about it disappearing and talking about it as a hoax. He seems to have shifted ground. There seems almost like a tectonic shift. And now the talk originally was $2.5 billion. Chuck Schumer came back and said we need at least $8 billion. Now the president's talking about $7.5 billion. So there has been a serious shift from national headquarters, hasn't there?
Absolutely. And I mean, I personally feel it. As I've been reporting on this, I've been telling people, I told my neighbors last weekend, don't worry about it. Your kids aren't going to get it, which is still true. Kids are probably not going to get this.
Kids are the most resistant.
Kids are the most resistant because they get cold viruses all the time. This is a coronavirus that's in the same family of diseases as the cold, the common cold. Kids are fighting this all the time. Their immune systems are prepped for this. At least that's the theory, because kids aren't getting this and no kids have died from this so far. So mostly who's at risk are older folks, and people between 30 and 70 are who are getting this. But yeah, like to answer your question, the tenor is changing, I think, within all of us, including myself and including the president, in terms of taking this more seriously. You know, I sat in front of you last Friday and said, we don't really need to worry. Here I am on Monday saying things are changing.
Well, Joe Alessandro is going to be joining us now. He's the president and CEO of the San Francisco Travel Association. He said we're not only talking about the coronavirus in terms of a broad view of where it's going and rapidly changing, but we wanted to find out some things about the economy. Joe, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning to you. How do things look in terms of tourism? We're getting all kinds of different reports. Give us a coherent sense of where we are.
Well, we're very concerned at a number of levels. We've had several conventions that were short-term in the next couple of months that have decided to either cancel or postpone because of oftentimes corporate travel policies, because many times our conventions in San Francisco have delegates from all over the world, and people are afraid sometimes of traveling and being stuck in quarantine or something like that and have liability issues. But also just in China, for example, China is our number one overseas market in terms of visitation and also in terms of tourism spend in San Francisco. And a month and a half ago, we had 80 wide-body flights a week between San Francisco and China, and today we have none. So there's no question that this impact of this is going to be significant. And what we're worried about is not only the fact that our economy is going to be hurting, but also in this extremely expensive city, people will be losing jobs because there's just not the visitor spend. And there's about 90,000 San Franciscans employed in the travel industry. So we're concerned. We also don't want people to panic, because the fact of the matter is the Department of Public Health in San Francisco says it's still safe to gather in public meetings and events here in San Francisco. And so we're just monitoring the situation very closely.
But you have to wonder when big giants like Twitter and Amazon are telling their employees to avoid non-essential travel, and when Facebook, for that matter, shuts down its major conference.
Absolutely. Those are giant concerns for us. And you know, there's no kind of idea right now of how long this will last. So any group or any travel, you know, between now and the next couple of months is in a period of question, and that's a big concern. But we know we'll get through this. You know, we went through SARS, we went through 9/11, and we always rebound, and the travel industry is very resilient. But our concern is for the immediate future and people who are dependent on their livelihood in a very expensive place and how that could impact them.
Joe, I appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Joe D'Alessandro, who is president and CEO of the San Francisco Travel Association. We're going to bring Christopher Thornburg on now, who's founding partner of Beacon Economics. They're an independent economic research and consulting firm. They're headquartered in L.A. Good to have you back with us, Chris Thornburg. Good morning.
Nice to be with you. I wish it was under happier circumstances.
And so do I. But in the meantime, one could be a little bit happier about the market. It's taken a better turn, hasn't it?
It has, but to be honest with you, I haven't paid much of attention to the stock market. It's worth remembering that a year ago, the markets were down 20%. Seriously, just a year ago they were. And that time it was about panics about real estate downturns, the potential for another recession and everything else. And, of course, by midsummer, the markets were back to record high. The one thing I can guarantee is that the stock market overreacts to everything right now, and therefore paying much attention to it and using it as some sort of signal to gauge what to think about this virus is simply going to lead people down bad paths.
We're in kind of a serious and uber uncertainty here, a profound uncertainty, aren't we?
No, I wouldn't say it's profound uncertainty. Look, we've dealt with pandemics of various sorts in the past. MERS and SARS were different versions of this, not as contagious, but far more deadly. Certainly, we have been anticipating something like this for years. We understand in this modern global interconnected world with these very dense urban centers that the potential for this has always been there. I think in a very real way, we're learning an important lesson, and I hope that we come out of this event much smarter than we went into it.
When I talk about profound uncertainty, I'm thinking about the panic buying, and I'm thinking about the fact that, people are buying supplies in ways that things are just flying off the shelves. I don't know if we saw that in SARS or MERS in those pandemics, did we?
Not to this extent, of
not
course.
Not to this extent at all, no.
Quite as much, yeah.
No, but I'm also concerned, as I'm sure you are, about the fact that how's this going to hit the GDP, people are wondering, is a recession up ahead? I mean, there's a word from the Fed that maybe it's just a matter of time before interest rates get cut, but maybe it's a matter of time before the recession hits.
Well, for something to cause a recession, and this, I'm glad you went there because this is a great starting point in terms of our thinking on this issue. For something to cause a recession, it has to be a large shock to the system, and this is certainly large. It has to be rapid, and this certainly came out of nowhere. But the most important thing is that it has to be sustained. And I think that's the greatest point of uncertainty here. How long will this go on? Realistically, after 10 years of relatively good growth, most companies have some money in-house. They should be relatively prepared to muddle through a couple bad quarters. Certainly, companies don't start laying off people as a result of just 6 months of disruption. And let's keep in mind, when you think about this hit to the economy, well, what sectors are going to suffer? Well, travel, tourism, think of conferences, airlines, hotels, no doubt about it. But at the same time, there are other parts of the economy that are booming right now. Healthcare is busy. All these products that are flying off the shelves, those companies are going to be crazy busy trying to catch up. And certainly strengths driven by this crisis in some parts of the economy will go to some extent, not completely, obviously, to fixing some of the holes created in other parts of the economy.
Yeah, I'm reading that Flex here in the Bay Area could benefit from this. Clorox over in Oakland could benefit from this.
Exactly.
But I mentioned a recession because, first of all, former Federal Board Chair Janet Yellen said Europe could actually throw us into a recession. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. But also, we're also facing the uncertainty of the virus spreading in ways that maybe we can't gauge entirely.
I couldn't agree more. Again, there is a lot of uncertainty out here. But my thought process on this is very straightforward. We need to all take a lesson from China. And what we learned from China is, yeah, you might have to get very tough in the short run here. You might have to enforce some fairly draconian restrictions on the movement of people and maybe even go so far as to close down schools for a couple weeks. I realize this is going to throw a lot of disruption into people's lives, but the tougher we are up front, the more likely we are to get in front of this and prevent it from spreading, and therefore more likely we are to make sure that this thing's gone by Q2, and that will almost assuredly mean there's no lasting effects.
But I have to ask you about small businesses, Chris, because some of them are very vulnerable. Restaurants, Chinatown is hurting as a result of this. Can they even weather a short downturn?
One would say maybe not. I don't know, to be honest with you. A lot of that, I think, is going to depend on the government's reaction. One would think that if you really wanted to make sure this thing doesn't have too many lasting effects, you would want to, create some sort of funds to help those kind of companies make it through this, make sure they have access to credit. But even so, let's say this does have a hit and a few of these restaurants that are on the margin do end up shutting down. Again, that's not a recession-causing event in its own right, because people may be spending that money elsewhere, thus creating, if you will, a transference of economic spending rather than a sheer overall decline in economic spending. But again, all that optimism is based on this thing being gone by Q2. If it gets into Q3, I think the chance of it causing a recession is going to go up remarkably. And that boils down to the idea that some short-run pain can lead to long-run gain on this. We're just going to have to accept that something has to happen pretty draconian in the short run to make sure this thing doesn't get out of control.
Didn't investment decline the last three quarters here in California in 2019?
No, I would say not. Maybe a small amount, but nothing too dramatic. Now, mind you, what's going on overall in the U.S. has been a slowdown in a lot of business spending, particularly on the commercial real estate structure side, whether it's oil wells or some new office buildings. But there's plenty of things being built right now, and I don't see that slowing down anytime in the near future.
Well, Leslie McClurg, you don't have a crystal ball or tea leaves, but can you talk about how we might be in this for a while?
Yeah. So what could happen? Some experts are comparing this to the 1918 Spanish flu. And sort of the reason they're doing that is that the...
That's really a scary comparison.
That's a very scary comparison. But if we look at that as a potential model, because the mortality rate was fairly similar, if we look at that as a model, they had a wave in the spring, and then the virus went away, over the summer, and then there was another wave in the fall. And so that's the potential that we could be seeing here. This is the reason public health experts are worried about COVID-19 or this new coronavirus, is that it is both, and this word is important, it is moderately contagious and moderately deadly. So it's not really contagious and it's not really deadly, but it's that combination. And so a lot of people could get this. And so that wave is what we could be seeing. And so that's why it could be getting into, like he said, Q3 or Q4. Those are economic terms, but third or fourth quarter.
KQED science reporter Leslie McClurg with us in studio, and Christopher Thornburg with us by phone, founding partner of Beacon Economics. And you can be with us. In fact, let me invite you to join the program. If you have some questions or comments, we want to hear from you. And I want to know how the virus is really affecting your daily routine, what we call the quotidian, you know, the normal part of your life. And if it has, let us know what the situation is. We'd like to hear from you, and you can call us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. You can join us at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or responses you might have to forum@kqed.org. And here's Sylvia, who writes, My hairdresser just canceled my appointment. She thinks she has the virus. She's had a fever for several days with moderate symptoms. She's had a flu shot and had not had the flu for decades. She is self-quarantining. From a public health perspective, should she be tested solely for purposes of tracking the spread? Leslie?
She should call her doctor, and she should walk through the questions with her doctor. That's the best thing for her to do. Every case is individual, and I think I would be way out of my line of work to advise whether or not that's the right decision. But I'm really glad that she's being cautious, and I think any of us that are sick right now, it's a good idea to stay home.
And what do we know? Let me go back to you for a moment, if I can, here, Chris Thornburg. What do we know about how anxiety affects the markets and the effect of that?
Well, I think you're seeing it already. Everybody's canceling. You're going to have employees potentially staying away from work. Hopefully they will, particularly if they're showing any symptoms. Again, everybody getting a little panicked will actually, at some level, help us get in front of this thing. And so let's be glad about that. I have to tell you, I was a little taken aback by the comparison to the Spanish flu, which killed 50 million people.
A lot more than the First World War, yeah.
Yeah, and I find it hard to believe that in this day and age we're going to let this get to that particular point, and I don't think we will. But to your point...
Your lips to God's ears, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and you go to that next step and say, well, what will people do? Well, they're not going to travel. They're not going to spend money on tourism. But they will spend money on something, because they may be buying health products, they may be doing this or that. It's really when you see an aggregate decline in consumer spending that this thing really becomes very dangerous for the health of the U.S. economy. And I don't think we're seeing that just yet. You know, I like to think of this almost as what happened after September 11th, where for over a year, year and a half, you saw a dramatic decline in overall the pace of tourism and travel and everything else. Yet the U.S. economy actually was in recovery mode from the tech downturn. And that's because people simply shifted their attention and their spending to other parts of the economy. We don't have a clear roadmap here, but for me, I feel like that's a good way of thinking about this. And as long as people just, like I said, continue to spend at something, I think we'll be okay.
Well, speaking of people spending, I'm looking at a comment from a listener named Plymouth who writes, can we please stop referring to people stocking up on groceries and hand sanitizer as panic buying? This is people following practical advice that has been given by multiple health agencies. From my personal visit to the grocery store yesterday, I didn't see anything that looked like panic, just a normal day of people buying their usual groceries, maybe in slightly larger amounts. But Leslie, some of the reporting that I've read dispels the notion that Plymouth has written here. Certain places, I was reading about Costco and El Cerrito and places where just the number of people who are buying has extraordinarily gone up.
I think the listener makes a good point in the sense that we live in an earthquake zone. We should all be prepared for a month anyways. And so what these people are doing is not panic in the sense that they are stocking up on these supplies, but we should have already had them. So in that sense, if you go outside right now, it's going to feel like panic to stock up, but that's just smart. If we are, you know, going to stay home for a week or a month to slow this thing down, we want to be prepared.
Let me bring a caller on, and that's Kenneth, who's joining us from Solano County. Kenneth, welcome. You're on the air with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I just wanted to say, let's not forget this was a complete botched response from the Trump administration, bringing people to Travis, then getting them out in the public, getting them to other hospitals, not telling us about it. They were in Kaiser and Vallejo, but they only said they're at the Queen of the Valley in Napa. This is something we should all be concerned about, but I agree that we should treat it as we do live in earthquake zone. So let's be prepared and make sure we do the right thing. I've got little ones and want to make sure that I'm safe for the family.
Well, thank you, Kenneth. Good to hear from you. And we're coming up on a break here, but let me go back to you, Chris Starnberg, just for a quick question from a listener who writes, we're about to sell our home. In fact, it goes on the market on Saturday. We're worried that this virus will have impact on the sale. What impact might it have on the housing market?
That's an interesting question. Well, to be honest with you, if you're in the market to buy a home right now, you have to be excited by the crazy drop in interest rates. The 10-year bond is running about 1%. If that stays in place for a little while, people are going to be seeing record low interest rates. And, you know, that goes back to what I was saying. Maybe you're not going to take that trip to, I don't know, Tanzania or Italy. However, you might decide to go ahead and get that new house purchased. I don't see this having any effect on that, to be honest with you. And in fact, if anything, again, low interest rates will actually cause a little bit of a stimulus there.
Well, we're going to talk more about the coronavirus's effect on the economy as the CDC upgrades the risk to the highest level. And again, we're going to take more of your calls. Leslie McClurg with us, science reporter for KQED, and Christopher Thornburg, who's founding partner of Beacon Economics. You can join us, and we invite you to do that. Toll-free number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the coronavirus and its effect on the economy, and talking about the CDC upgrading risk to the highest level and what it means here in the Bay Area and beyond. With us in studio is Leslie McClurg, who is KQED science reporter, and with us by phone is Chris Thornburg, who's founding partner of Beacon Economics. I want to bring Mike Zampa into this. He's a spokesperson for the Port of Oakland. Mike, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning to you. And let's talk about what's happening in the Port of Oakland, particularly in terms of ships being canceled, and a lot of them from China, aren't they?
Well, U.S. ports, including Oakland, are beginning to see the effects from coronavirus. And the clearest indicator, yes, you're right, shipping lines have been canceled dozens of voyages now. And many of those, yes, do originate in China. In fact, the Port of Oakland does about 30 to 40% of its trade with China.
But there's also kind of a holdover that people aren't necessarily aware of. I mean, there's time that the ships actually spend in L.A. and in Long Beach before they come to Oakland, isn't it generally?
not traditionally, in every instance, about 1,500 ships a year come to Oakland. Every one of them stops first in Los Angeles or Long Beach and then makes its way up the coast.
And the concern there in terms of the virus and, you know, holding a ship and all of that, under your aegis, what are we finding out?
Well, the Coast Guard has issued a regulation that ship crews cannot depart the vessel while they're on at a U.S. port if they have been in China in the previous 14 days. Now, you're right, that is not a big thing for Oakland. It takes a vessel, say, 11 to 12 days to cross the Pacific from China. Then those ships spend 3 to 5 days in Los Angeles or Long Beach before they get here. So by the time they are in Oakland, if the crew members have been in China, that incubation period for coronavirus is well past. So we have not had an issue with crew members in Oakland so far.
What about, Mike, if you could talk about the impact on port workers and truckers from cancellations?
Well, that remains to be seen over the next few months, and that is really our concern. At the Port of Oakland, we're at the center of international trade, so we are accustomed to the ups and downs of the global economy. The concern is for customers and workers, as you say, who depend on the port. Will importers get the goods they need for assembly lines or store shelves? Will California growers find enough ship space to export farm goods? And yes, there are 84,000 jobs connected to the Port of Oakland. Those may be longshore workers or warehouse workers or railroad employees. Will this impact them? That all to be sorted out in the next few months. Too soon to say. We next week should get cargo volume numbers for February, and that could be the first indicator of what impact the coronavirus is having on the port's business.
Just a subjective question, maybe, but you feel you're on top of this?
Yes, we do. We're operating normally. There have been no incidents related to coronavirus at the port. We are following Coast Guard regulations closely, monitoring the CDC. So far, we don't see anything untoward developing from coronavirus. The thing we watch now is, will there be an impact to cargo volumes and to business, and as you say, to jobs in Northern California?
And we will continue to monitor it here on KQED. Mike, thanks for joining us. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
It's Mike Zampa, spokesperson for the Port of Oakland. I'm going to bring Megan Green aboard now. She's an economist and senior fellow with the Harvard Kennedy School. And good to have you with us, Megan Green. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the place to begin with you is the supply side. I know that's your area of expertise. And if you could give us a general picture, I'd be much appreciative.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that the coronavirus really poses both a demand and a supply side issue for the economy. But the supply side issue is much bigger. So on the demand side, you know, having the second biggest economy in the world come to a standstill for at least 5 weeks, that's going to hit the amount of stuff that's been purchased. But the idea with that is that once you actually contain the virus, all these people who haven't been buying stuff, once they can again, it'll unleash all this pent up demand. And a year from now, we won't really feel the implications of that demand shock. The supply shock is kind of our ability to make and provide goods and services. And because China is so well integrated into global supply chains, and because just-in-time manufacturing is really in fashion now, so a lot of companies have very thin inventories, that means that if any cog in this long global supply chain isn't working, the whole supply chain might as well be down. And so ramping that supply chain back up could be really problematic because every single piece needs to work. And also in terms of policy responses, responding to a demand shock is not as difficult. The central bank can cut rates, for example, governments can step in, but we don't really have great tools for the kind of supply side shock that we're facing. So for example, investors are all demanding that central banks cut rates now, but it's not like this issue is really caused by borrowing costs being too high. If you cut rates, it won't make people go out and buy stuff. It won't make people go back to factories in China to produce the part that Western companies need in their complicated good. And so we don't have great tools to actually do anything about this. And that's the biggest concern.
Well, as you said, the central banks can maybe deal with the demand side, but they have problems on the supply side. They simply, to use your words, don't have the tools. But I'm wondering about supply side problems in terms of, well, finding suppliers that are backups or finding other kinds of suppliers, new suppliers, in other words. We were trying to do that during the talk about trade tariffs, for example, to a great degree.
That's right. So what we found is that for Western companies, for example, that uses small Chinese firm for a part that they need to produce what they sell, if there were an easier, cheap alternative to that Chinese company, they would have already found it back when the U.S. started imposing tariffs on China and launched this trade war. So the easy supply chains to shift have already been shifted. Now we're looking at much more complicated supply chain shifts, largely because they're more expensive. And so a lot of firms are either looking at having to shift their supply chains and pay more, so you know they won't be as profitable, or they're looking at potentially having to go out of business. And it takes a while to shift a supply chain generally as well. So if we do have companies shifting supply chains now, in addition to that eating into their margins, if this virus is contained and China is back up online, it's not like those firms are going to go and shift their supply chains back necessarily just because of all the switching costs that are involved in shifting your supply chain to begin with.
Let me remind you that Megan Green is on the line with us now, economist and senior fellow of the Harvard Kennedy School. And I'm going to read a tweet from Karen. We were talking before about panic buying, and Karen says, I work at a health food store in Cupertino, and our numbers are double what we make during Christmas and Thanksgiving combined. We're selling out of water and hand sanitizer by noon. Retail workers are getting overwhelmed. Here's Mike, who writes, I'm a small-scale olive oil producer in Solano County. I bottle the oil in glass from Italy. There is no suitable domestic alternative. Anticipating a possible supply chain disruption from Italy, I've ordered a load of bottles 6 months ahead of schedule. And let me go to our callers, and we begin with a caller from Sunnyvale. Smitty, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. We're hearing a lot about, you know, people, what to do and avoid getting infected. But the fact is a significant percentage of our population will be. And if you're part of that, what should you expect? I mean, how should you react to it in terms of, other than just, you know, isolation and stuff, what should the public expect? And I think knowing that will be very useful in determining the level of panic you should feel if you are one of the people who are detected.
Thank you for that question. Let me go to Leslie McClurg.
Yeah, I think we need to remember that 80% of folks who are going to get this, they're just going to recover like they would from the flu. So the best thing to do if you get sick, if you have these symptoms, which is cough and fever, is to stay home, to rest, and to hydrate. If you start to have trouble breathing, you need to call your doctor and they can advise from there. But there is no sort of like magic potion in terms of how you're going to take care of yourself. Wash your hands so you don't get it and stay home if you get sick.
And let me thank the caller and go right to another caller. And that caller is Jack. Jack, you're on the air.
Hey, I was in a produce store just two nights ago, and I was trapped way at the very back of the store or I would have left immediately. I couldn't get out of the store fast enough. There was a woman walking in, coughing and coughing and coughing without covering her mouth, and there's all this produce everywhere. And I just think that, you know, we have to set up a new standard about what you do to quarantine yourself, or having stores be smart enough to, you know, redirect that woman out of the store immediately and not even allow her to get in the door.
Jack, you raise an important point. I'd like to go back to Leslie on this. I mean, self-quarantine is very important in terms of doing whatever we can to thwart this soon-to-be pandemic, probably. And self-quarantine, the message really has to go out to the people.
I think it's really, really important. It's why on the air, as often as I can, I'm trying to be like, stay home, people. There is a culture in Americans to go to work even when you're sick. I do it all the time, or until now. I'm not going to do it anymore. But we need to put that culture away, and we really need to stay home right now. We want to contain this thing so we can get through this moment and move on.
More evidence of people talking about panic buying or the nature of buying. This is from a listener who says, I was in Sunnyvale, Trader Joe's, This Sunday, and the shelves were empty for certain products. There was not a can of tuna, jar of peanut butter, bag of rice, can of beans, or bag of pasta to be found. They still had lots of perishable goods. I talked with some of the staff there, and they said that people were definitely panic buying. They weren't just buying a few more things. They were filling their carts to the brim. Sundays are normally busy days, but it looked to me that it was busier than normal. I think about that listener at Plymouth who said, don't get panicky about panic buying, but some are certainly attesting to it, and we're getting different reports on that score. I want to ask you, if I could, Chris Thornburg, a question. I happen to see an article in The Atlantic about the effect on the gig economy of this. It's never really been tested in a pandemic, and Uber and Instacart, for example, are doing some special preparation and so forth, but some companies are actually considering planning along these lines. But is there a way to gauge the effect on the economy itself?
Absolutely not. I mean, we're truly in uncharted territory, in as much as we do have this modern economy where we can communicate and work and buy stuff without actually having a lot of personal interaction. I'm going to go back to why that actually is a positive for our economy. When you think about it, the ability for people to stay home, isolation to prevent spread can actually be helped by, of course, those systems, whether it's, you know, Instacart or Uber Eats and everything else. Of course, as long as those drivers aren't sick, and I think that that's where things get a little tricky. How are Uber and Lyft and all those other companies going to make sure that they are helping the problem rather than exacerbating it by becoming vectors of transmission? Again, I think every company, whether it's these gig companies or just the standard old payroll companies, everybody needs to be thinking long and hard about how do we weather this situation? How do we get through this? These are good lessons, by the way. I would say that we've been looking out for this kind of event for decades now. We know in our hyper-urbanized environment that something like this could happen. I think we should all be thankful that it's this, because this isn't all that bad relative to, say, if a MERS or a SARS had become this contagious, then we'd really be in a big problem. So let's weather this storm and learn our appropriate lessons.
And again, Christopher Thornburg with us, is founding partner of the Beacon Economics, an independent economic research and consulting firm headquartered in L.A. And it's good to have you with us, Chris. Thanks for joining us this segment.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me go back, Megan Green, if I could, to you. Megan Green, again, is an economist and senior fellow with the Harvard Kennedy School. There's concern. I just want to get maybe a global picture for a moment. There's a lot of concern about the effect on Europe and Japan, particularly with only 1% growth, being vulnerable to recession. And we spoke earlier in this hour about recession. But there also was an article in the New York Times that said that global growth could actually be cut in half. That's according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. I don't know, does that seem perhaps hyperbolic to you or over the top, especially when there's so much we can't know here?
Yeah, so I think, you know, you're right to point out that Europe and Japan are particularly vulnerable to the coronavirus. And that's partly because both Europe and Japan came into this from a real position of weakness. So Japan's economy contracted pretty significantly in the last quarter of last year. And so did the Italian and French economies, and Germany pretty much stagnated. So they're not coming into this from a position of strength. But to say that global growth will be cut in half, I think that's probably overstating it a little bit. That being said, you know, it's not impossible that the U.S. could go into a recession as a result of this. There's a lot of uncertainty around that. It's not my base case scenario, but it's certainly possible now. And it all depends on how long it takes us to actually contain this virus, but also more importantly, how people respond to it. So the coronavirus, to some degree, has been a catalyst, but it's really the fear virus that is causing the tanking in the markets and also such a huge hit in the economy.
And we go to more of your calls. We bring Greg on next. Greg, join us. You're on Forum.
Good morning. I just want to say, you know, I don't think there's a lot of mystery here. If you look at China, what they're doing, you know, they're closing down schools until, you know, late April. You know, the list of things that they've had to do to try to mitigate the damage from this is going to be it's catastrophic. And I don't think the U.S., just the fact that we've, you know, taken so long just to get the kids up and running, we just basically, you know, didn't get ahead of it. And I kind of it bothers me to just mix message. Oh, it's bad. Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, don't worry. It's, oh, worry. You know, it's like, it's a, you know, contagious disease. We all should be very concerned to be taking the precautions necessary and learning from what China has experienced already.
Let me go to you on this, if I could, Megan Green. I mean, what have we really learned as a result of China's response to this virus? And we don't really have a lot of data at this point to really go on, do we?
We don't. And a lot of the data that we have is coming out of China, right? So is susceptible to an official filter, so to speak. So we know that there's been kind of draconian isolation and quarantining in China. And it seems like that has had a real effect on the number of new cases within China. So that's positive. But we don't know a whole lot about things like the mortality rate from the coronavirus, in part because it's coming out of numbers that are being released by China. In terms of economic data, over the weekend, we got new PMI data. So Chinese purchasing managers are asked about their views on new orders and imports and prices and employment. We saw the lowest figures that we've ever seen come out of China. And that was official data. So that was with an official screen. So you could, you know, you could think actually the data might have been even worse, but that's all that Chinese authorities were being allowed to be published. And so the economic data, between that and other indicators such as coal usage, for example, to get a gauge on the Chinese economy's performance, suggests that China's really seen demand drop massively and output drop massively. But again, if the virus can be contained and we can go ahead and release that pent-up demand, what we've seen with other kind of exogenous shocks like SARS, other disasters like this, hurricanes are another example, is that you get this huge drop in the short term, but then if the event passes, there's pent-up demand, and a year from then, you don't really notice the implications of that. So I think the supply-side implications of this are much trickier, and I would agree with the previous caller in saying that actually the U.S. is kind of behind the eight ball on this one. As of last Friday, the president was still suggesting that the coronavirus was a hoax, so that doesn't give you much confidence that authorities are coming up with contingency plans. Things like what Hong Kong has done, which is kind of print money and hand it out as checks, or things that, you know, South Korea has done, which is to make provisions for tight credit in the system. The Federal Reserve in the U.S. is more constrained in terms of what it can buy, and so what kind of provisions it can make for a seizing up of the credit markets. And for the Treasury's part, it's not clear that they're actually ahead of the eight ball figuring out exactly what they can do to mitigate the implications. So the U.S. is kind of getting a late start to this.
Well, Megan Green mentions, Leslie McClurg, concern about federal inaction on this initially. And now there's a lot of concern about Mike Pence, the vice president, being put in charge because his record on science particularly is wanting, shall we say, to put it mildly. But the reality is that others say, well, he's just a figurehead. He'll get good people there.
To be determined, I think, is my response to that.
Now, let me bring some more callers aboard here. Let's get Minka into this discussion here. Minka, you're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. My son is scheduled to go to a soccer camp in Barcelona, leaving this Friday. How worried should we be about travel to Europe, and what can we do to protect him?
Listen. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, right now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, there's no travel restrictions on Spain. So you should be okay. The government is not recommending that you stay home. However, neighboring country, you know, Italy, they is at a level 3. They are not recommending anyone go to Italy. So my recommendation is to go to the CDC's website and read those recommendations, and then kind of on a case by case, this is really an individual decision on whether or not you want to take that risk. I mean, there's no risk on the ground right now, but could things change quickly? They could.
And I'll read a comment from a listener named Red who writes, I find it appalling to hear physicians and public health officials saying things like, we hope employers will be understanding and give employees time off who show symptoms, etc. Employers should be required to give time off without penalty and encourage their workers who show symptoms to not show up at work. This is not a matter for passive voluntary cooperation. And Stephanie writes, let me go to you on this, Megan Green. I don't believe that people will spend as much on extra groceries and hand sanitizers than they would on travel. Also, if businesses are closed and hourly workers are not able to work, they'll be forced to pare down spending. And in the Bay Area, we so many families on the edge of homelessness, I believe this virus will increase homelessness. Some thoughts on increase of homelessness, Megan Green?
So you could see an increase in homelessness. I mean, it's a really good point that they've made in terms of hourly workers not getting paid time off. And so it is a great suggestion to just not go to work if you're sick. But lots of people can't afford to do that. And a lot of those people are in, for example, you know, the food industry. So they're preparing our food. And so them going to work, for example, could, you know, increase or accelerate the spread of the coronavirus. And so this is really bringing to bear a huge weakness in our healthcare system that we're not going to address in the short term. But I do think that, you know, people being unable to go to work and just not getting paid as a result of it could have real implications for their spending, because of course, in economics, everybody knows that it's the people at the bottom, in the bottom tier of incomes, who actually spend the largest percentage of what they're making. And so that will have an impact on demand. And for those people, some of them will have a real squeeze and could end up homeless, as one example, but that's an extreme case.
Well, I think employers really should take note of that comment from a listener. But for many employers, it's difficult to be, well, granting voluntary leave to their employees. I mean, we get into all those issues here, but that's for another hour, perhaps. Let me get a caller on. Christopher, that's you calling from Palm Springs. You're on the air.
Yeah, so actually I live in San Francisco, and I'm a driver for both Uber and Lyft, and I also do Uber Eats. I was wanting to respond to the previous comment by the guy who said about, you know, how it could help the, you know, like wasn't sure, unsure with like delivery food. Well, I have a lot of passengers coming out of my car, and I also do Uber Eats, which, I mean, it's not like a regular delivery driver who just him and the food. You know, if I have like 200 people in a week, and I'm also delivering food out of that car, you know, there's no Uber or Lyft don't mention this to the driver too. Say, oh, if you're delivering food, make sure to keep your car clean. Or they're not even letting consumers know that, obviously for monetary reasons, that like, oh, your person that is delivering your food could also be in contact with 200 people in a week.
Well, you certainly sent out a caveat in that comment of yours, Christopher, and I'm appreciative of your calling, and thank you for that. We'll go right to another caller in Sacramento. Pam joins us. Morning, Pam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, I guess. My question is, are we ramped up on testing yet? I keep hearing all weekend, like on your show today, people casually say, all you can do is wash your hands and be careful. Well, great. But we should be testing the scattershot of sick people around the sick people. Not of sick people, but around the sick people. And then we will understand infection rates. But it's nonsensical to say we know infection spread and rates because we don't. So yes or no answer, are we testing extensively yet?
Pam, thank you for that question. Let me go back to testing with you, Leslie McClurg. I was with Representative Jackie Speer last night, and she was comparing the number of test kits in South Korea to the number of test kits we have here. And we are not in a situation that South Korea is in, but we are certainly not in a situation comparable to them in terms of test kits.
Yeah, the governor tried to relay our fears about this on Friday in a press, or last week in a press conference about this, that the testing kits are coming and that should be happening, you know, today or shortly. I have heard that the CDC and the FDA have said that the problem with the testing has been rectified and we can test more people. But clarity from our officials around what's possible and how fast those tests can happen is still coming. It should be clear, you know, today or tomorrow, hopefully, and testing can ramp up quickly. I will say to relay the fears from the caller that if someone is testing positive, the CDC is on the ground, you know, on sort of, you know, boot leather detective work, making sure that those people around that person are either quarantined or tested. So,
well, it's taken a delay in many cases to get the CDC to confirm.
Absolutely. It is. Well, assume, yeah, exactly. Until now, and hopefully this is changing radically as I speak, there has been a 2 to 4 day delay because tests have had to be confirmed by sending them to Atlanta at the CDC. So hopefully that's changing quickly.
We also have a listener who wants clarification on incubation period. Leslie, you know about that. Can you clarify?
Yeah. So the incubation period is anywhere from a few days to 14 days is what we know on the ground right now.
And another listener writes, as the number of tests increase, there will be massive increases in the number of cases. This is definitional. It is not a reason for major concern. So far, there is no data that COVID-19 is substantially worse than various common flus. Bottom line, the panic will impact us far greater than the disease. There are many, Megan Green, who are taking that attitude when it comes to the economy. We have more to fear about fear itself than perhaps a disease in our economy.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that affects both particularly the demand side, but also to some degree the supply side. And we've seen, you know, we've seen it with what we call animal spirits in the markets, for example. So the massive corrections that we've seen in both, you know, equity and bond markets over the past week suggest that investors are all freaked out and planning for the worst at this point and demanding real significant intervention by policymakers. And that might not be warranted based on where this is going, but there's just so much uncertainty around it and so much uncertainty around the numbers that, it, you know, it human nature lends itself to overreacting. And I think we've seen that, and that makes the impact on the economy much worse.
Megan Green, I only have seconds left here, but a listener wants to know what you think about China's role and risks associated with the U.S. drug supply chain.
So China is a huge producer of pharmaceuticals for the U.S., and so China coming to a standstill will probably have implications for U.S. drug chains. But, you know, Chinese factories are getting back to work at different rates in different provinces, so it all depends on how long those Chinese factories are down.
Megan Green, appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
Thanks.
Megan Green is an economist, senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School, senior fellow at Chatham School, Chatham House, that is. And thank you, Leslie McClurg.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us as well. Leslie McClurg is science reporter for KQED. We also spoke to Joey D'Alessandro, the San Francisco Travel Association, and others. Mike Zampa from Oakland. Another hour ahead.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.